So this is a teaching from the Dhammapada. Some of you may be familiar with it. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts we make the world. Speak or act with an impure mind, and trouble will follow you as the wheel follows the ox that draws the cart. We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unshakable. How can a troubled mind understand the way? Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your own thoughts, unguarded. But once mastered, no one can help you as much, not even your father or your mother. So we are what we think. No, I was asking myself, you know, what is a thought? I had to do quite a bit of thinking about a lot of things before I somehow came to an acceptable conclusion. And I'm glad I don't have to share the thoughts in between that. And I'd like to start out with a story, and it was told to me by Joseph Goldstein, but I'm sure that it's out there somewhere. It's a story of a conversation between the captain of an American aircraft carrier and a Canadian. So the captain of the aircraft carrier out in the ocean observed a light, and he sent out an order. He said, change direction, move 15 degrees north. And the reply from the Canadian side, unable to do so, you move. This is the captain of the ship, change direction, move 15 degrees north. Reply, unable to do so. This is the captain of U.S. aircraft carrier Lincoln, 5 cruisers and 2 destroyers. Command, you move immediately or we will take appropriate action. Answer, this is a lighthouse. Our thoughts begin with perceptions. That is the way that we see things, and then we explain them to ourselves. And then we project them out into the world and believe they're true. And as the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, said, you know, all of our problems come from misperceptions. Now, in the Buddhist understanding, just to go back to what is a thought, in the Buddhist understanding, there are 6 senses. The 5 that we know of, you know, hearing, seeing, feeling, tasting, and these other sensations that we have in the body. But in Buddhist understanding, the 6th one is thinking. It sees the mind as a 6th sense. And the thought is to the mind as an aroma is to the nose, or a barking dog is to the ear. So thinking, basically, is just what the mind does, and thoughts are just what the mind produces. Why, then, do we have so much difficulty with our thoughts? It seems kind of strange. But if you look at the process, here's what happens. What we perceive, we think about. And what we think about, we complicate. And what we complicate, then we pass around as truth. We think it's true. We observe something, and then we already know what happened, or we have a story about it, or an opinion about it. We wouldn't say it was a story, and then that's what we relate. So that's the complication. The complication is this distorted or inaccurate version of what happened that we create. We can't see what really happened, usually because the mind is clouded by something. It's clouded by desire, or it's clouded by aversion, or it's clouded by just plain ignorance. And this misperception, these misperceptions, and these misperceptions held as truth and spread as truth, create our lives. That's how we create our lives. And I'd like to share a story with you that's not a particularly happy story, but it's I found it quite profound. We talk about our lives made from our perceptions. I'm reading from a book called Kitchen Table Wisdom, which some of you may be familiar with. The writer, I think you should know, the author is Rachel Naomi Raymond. She's a doctor in the United States in California. She's also a Buddhist practitioner. She's also a psychologist, and she's a co-founder of a cancer clinic in California. So the stories in this book are very moving and very illustrative of, what life is like, period. Just because it, from her perspective, which is fairly wide, the stories that she tells are those that she's either experienced in her life growing up and with her family, or that she's experienced in her professional life. And this is a story from her own life, and it's called, I think it's called Good Fortune. And it's a story from her own life, a good fortune. And she tells a story of an experience in 1971 when her father won a lottery prize in New York State. She said it wasn't a huge amount of money by lottery standards, but it was more money than her dad had ever had or seen in his life in one place. And it was a real windfall for him. And she said it was a real windfall for her, too, not because of the money, but because of what happened next. Her father was in the hospital when he won the lottery, and he was recovering from a removal of a tumor, which turned out to be benign. And he taped the winning ticket to his chest, saying that no one could be trusted to redeem it, not anyone in his family or any of his friends, or not even her mother, which was his wife. He was convinced that someone would keep the ticket, or it would be stolen from them, from him, or the people at the lottery office wouldn't record it honestly once it had been handed over. And for a long time, he could not be persuaded to turn the ticket in. And so as the deadline to redeem the ticket grew nearer, he swore his mother to secrecy. He decided he was going to redeem it, but they couldn't tell anyone that he was redeeming it. And eventually did redeem it himself, but he never spent the money because he was afraid other people would know that he had it. So gradually, she says, she describes a kind of an anxiety that settled around them, because her father had always believed that the luck of the Raymonds, which was an expression he had, well, that's just the luck of the Raymonds, really meant that they did not have good luck at all, and so he couldn't risk anything. That was his belief. It was not good luck. He felt that love was a dangerous enterprise, and he felt overwhelmed by it. So there was no way his father could be lucky in this world. There was no way he could be. He could not even turn winning $50,000 into good fortune. He could turn it into misfortune, a source of grief and anxiety and stress. And until then, she had really believed that they were unlucky. And that changed eventually, but I'll tell you how it changed. So he had the money. He wouldn't spend it. And eventually, I guess when he and her mother decided to buy a little place, they retired, and they spent a little bit of the money on renovating this little retirement home. So Naomi, his daughter, believed that finally they were going to relax and enjoy their lives. He was retired. They had their little place. And for a while, she said his dreams seemed complete. And some months after the place was his, she stopped by on a Sunday visit, and she found him exhausted and asleep in his chair. And that was a familiar sight from her childhood when he came home from work exhausted, but she thought that things would be different now that he was retired. Her mother said, no, he was tired because he'd just taken a little job so they could afford to keep up their little retirement place, because things were always needing repair and deteriorating. Well, on her next visit, which was some months later, he was asleep in his chair again, and she said, are you enjoying yourselves? Well, Mom said, your father's afraid that someone will break in and take away everything we've worked for. He's still working because he wants to put in an alarm system. My heart sank. I asked how much it would cost, and my mother evaded me and she said they would have that enough money in just a little while. So a few months later, when Naomi visited again, her father was still looking very weary. And she asked why. And she said, when do you take a vacation? You should take a vacation. And my father shook his head, and not this year, we can't leave the house empty. I suggested a house sitter. My father was horrified. No, no, he told me, you know how people are. Even your friends never take care of your things the way you'd want them to be taken care of, not even the way they'd care for their own. And they never took another vacation. And she says, in the end, my parents rarely left the house together, not even to go to the movies. There could be a fire or some other sort of vague and unnamed disaster. And my father worked at odd jobs until he died. The house turned out to have been had far greater control over him than any of his former employers had. And she said, her comment is, if we fear loss enough, in the end, the things we possess will come to possess us. Now, that seemed to me when I first read it as, you know, all this man was just ridiculous. But, you know, I very quickly realized, as I'm sure you do, just how sad it is when we hold things in the mind that just don't make any sense at all, even to our own detriment. The thoughts we become attached to. And so then I was very curious to know, what is it? You know, what is it that allows us to do that? So not unlike the captain of the aircraft carrier, he just had a perception that I wasn't quite on. So what is a thought? Well, it's a product of the mind. And the product of this mind depends on our perception. And when the mind is clear, which is its natural state, and it's not clouded by anything, the mind can see the truth. We can see things as they really are. But when the mind is clouded, and these are the three major clouds that come by, when the mind is clouded by greed and all of its manifestations, our wants, ill will and all its manifestations, you know, anger and all of those related ideas, thoughts, and states of mind, or ignorance, that's when thoughts are a problem. Greed, hatred, and ignorance. And I recall in my practice, early years of practice, for quite a few years of practice, I would hear greed, hatred, and ignorance coming up in all kinds of contexts. And I thought, this is really archaic. You know, I really don't understand this. I have to say, I have an aversive mind, so I pushed away a lot of things just because they didn't make sense to me. Obviously, they didn't make sense to anybody. So, but it's just become so apparent that these three poisons or fetters, I mean, they have lots of names in the teachings, are so detrimental, and they so cloud the mind, and they so cloud our lives when we're compelled by them. So when the mind's in clear in its true state, and there is no sense of wanting or ill will or confusion or ignorance, we're fine. So I want to return to that later and just ask another question here, besides what is a thought, a product of the mind. Do thoughts ever stop? And I'm guessing, you know, when you do some sittings, you start to wonder that yourself. Does the mind ever stop? And the answer to that is no, not easily. And they actually don't stop because they are the product of an entrenched habit of mind. And until we let go of our habits of mind, our ways of thinking, our ways of perceiving, our ways of processing our experience, until we recognize those habits and get rid of them, we will continue to be churning out thoughts after thoughts after thoughts after thoughts, all of them from perceptions that are not clearly seen. An entrenched habit of mind is major complication. And that name of that complication is called papancha, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about it maybe tomorrow. When we think that quieting the mind means having no thoughts at all, we are badly mistaken. Quieting the mind does not mean getting rid of thoughts. When we're quieting the mind, what we're doing is we're ridding ourselves of these detrimental habits of mind. A habit of mind is just a way of seeing things, a way of responding over and over and over again. Now, maybe you don't have any habits that you wish you didn't have. I don't know. I have developed quite a few in my lifetime. And my experience is it's really difficult to rid myself of these habits, and I think that's pretty much it for many of us. We become what we practice. You know, when we want to become good at something, you know, be able to play tennis well or to play the piano or, you know, dance, whatever you really would love to do well, you practice. You get good instruction and you practice. And you become maybe a good pianist, or at least a pianist who enjoys playing the piano, or you become an adequate tennis player enough to enjoy the game, or become extremely proficient at it, or outstanding. You become what you practice. This is why we talk about the wise efforts and so on. We become what we practice. That's who we are. So when we have a mind that's clear, we're great. But when we're practicing from habits of mind that are detrimental to us, then this is what we're going to get, a mind that misperceives things and then believes that they're true. So quieting the mind is really quite simple. It's very much like mindfulness practice, which, of course, is what mindfulness practice is aimed at. Quieting the mind means paying absolute, undivided, uninterrupted attention to the moment without verbalizing the experience in the process. Get that again. This is a description of absolutely what we would like to be able to do. Quieting the mind means paying undivided and uninterrupted attention to what's happening in that moment without verbalizing it in the mind. That is, not talking about it, not describing it to yourself, not explaining it away to yourself, or none of that. It's just the pure experience. After lunch, you know, is a time when sloth and torpor and a little bit of sleepiness or heavy mind or heavy body comes into play. And, the mind goes, oh, I'm sleepy. Oh, I don't think that I had enough sleep last night. I know that's why I'm sleepy, or I had too much lunch. And it's really pointless of me to try to be mindful or to try to be sitting here. And so my mind is just, you know, like cold porridge. I just don't think I can pay attention to anything. It's because I didn't get enough sleep. So instead of using skillful means and saying, wait a minute, this is what's up on the radar screen, right? This is it. It's sleepiness. What does it feel like? Let's describe this experience and be interested in it, because it's obviously different from restlessness. And so we could ask ourselves legitimately, what's going on here in my senses that has me say, I'm sleepy? Let's get interested in it. The pure interest keeps you awake. Trust me, it does keep you awake. Although it is one of the most difficult of those energies that are so difficult. So instead of doing other skillful means or employing other skillful means, like standing up to help yourself stay awake, absolutely acceptable to stand up when you're doing sitting practice. It's standing practice. Or do walking practice. Or take deep breaths and become interested. This is an acceptable habit of mind. Here's something that's preventing me from being mindful. And you do it in your life. You're walking around. There's some things you should do. You have some explanations why you can't do that. You know, in other words, it's a habit of mind. It's a caving to something for whatever reasons. And then you just become able to excuse yourself because you have several reasons for doing that. That's the verbalizing of an experience that can be a habit of mind. You may know someone. You may have a child who's full of excuses all the time, of excusing, explaining things away, when another habit of mind might be to, well, what could I do about that? Or do I want to do something about that? You see, I'm going to be giving lots of very simplified examples because I think there might be one or two that some of you might be able to relate to. By the way, this constant describing, this internal dialogue, describing your experience to yourself is something that nearly drove me mad when I realized that I did that. I can remember being totally shocked and then really confused and angry when I realized that I was living my life with this whole little 2-second delay description of what had just happened, And I thought, what am I doing? Am I writing a memoir here and it's being taped somewhere, you know, and I've got an organ in here that's recording all of this? And it was incredibly upsetting for me. In fact, I think my aversion to it made it very, very difficult to drop it. There was so much resistance and no compassion at all. I still don't know why I did it, and I think probably a therapist could unwind that for me. Fortunately, it stopped, but it was incredibly painful to hear myself telling myself, as if I had another person beside me who couldn't see what I was doing, to describe it. It was terrible. But we all have that kind of an internal dialogue, whatever it is, and that those are the habits of mind that we have. Sometimes it isn't pure description. Sometimes it's catastrophizing. We can all do that. I don't know if we can all do it. I know I can do that as well. That's what I'm trying to say. I can recall the first time I really recognized that. And I'll just give you an example. A number of years ago, I was able to sit on a zafu for at least a year. And I remember as I got used to that posture, one leg would go to sleep partway through the sitting. And you know that feeling. So at first, you know, it's got this sort of funny, buzzy feeling, and then pretty soon it goes numb. And here's the mind goes, the habit of mind is like, oh my God, the circulation has stopped in my leg. That's what it means. I wonder how long you can go without circulation in your lower leg before they have to amputate. I wonder if I should get up right now and go somewhere to a clinic, or maybe I could stay and then have someone drive me. And it was like I had this leg amputated within 10 minutes. And I think that's another kind of a habit of mind, of rushing to the worst possible conclusion. Now, that astonished me because I had a very close friend whose really obvious habit of mind was to go to the very, jump to the very worst conclusion no matter what. You know, if it started to rain a bit, there was going to be a flood. I mean, she could not stop herself. So I didn't think that I was anything like that. But, you know, given the right circumstance, we can all manage that one. Again, but it can be a habit of mind. So when we fall into one of these mental habits, we do two things. One, we interrupt the experience. We interrupt the attention to the experience and we change it. The experience is happening and then we start describing it or excusing it or catastrophizing it. We have to verbalize something about it. And the second thing that we do is, of course, we perpetuate thinking. This is papancha. This is okay, I have this thought, and then I have this thought, and then I have this thought, and now I'm going to have my leg amputated. You know, that's a big jump from, I think my leg is going to sleep. But this is what happens. But when we train ourselves, this is it, when we train ourselves by constant practice, and that word constant, it's such as going on a retreat, taking 2 or 3 days, taking a week, taking 2 or 3 weeks, and we consistently practice noticing those habits of mind and not falling into them. That is how we cure ourselves of that. And this is why with a period of continuous practice, it seems as though the mind is quieter. It's because we've stopped that habit that leads to perpetuating thoughts. Is this making some sense? Because of that, then the mind, of course, can start to see things as they really are. Like the first time you realize, okay, I have this pain, and it could, and then you just stop and say, I think I'll just pay attention to my knee. And you just do that. You get curious and interested. And you learn something. One, the nature of pain or discomfort. And you also learn how it arises, how it passes away, what its nature is. And you don't bother with a whole lot of verbalization about what it could be, where it came from, and you know what psychological damage was done in your youth that you're experiencing this now. You know, it's when we train ourselves by constant practice, that is, on retreat, or you can do self-retreat as well. You don't have to go away, but you have to train yourself to see that habit and not fall into it. And there are many, many times when we're not meditating that we aren't verbalizing. There are many times outside of meditation when we have no interruption of our experience with words. Like when you have an intuition, for example. You know, you think that's some kind of magic that you intuit something, you just suddenly say, oh, I know what's happening, or I know what the reason for that is. You haven't been thinking about it, it just pops up. So the mind can do this without generating a lot of thought. It's a wonder, and the more the mind is, the clearer the mind is, the more frequent we can have those experiences. But that's all they are. It's just, it's knowing without having done a lot of thinking. It's just suddenly the mind says, here, this is what you know. This is what you know. When we listen to music, we don't verbalize. You sit and listen to any kind of music, you're just there with the music. You hear a bird singing, bird song outside. You don't verbalize about that, it's just there. Probably the easiest way to go directly to the experience is when we're present for our sense experience, like hearing, or running in the wind, or just sitting with the wind in your face. There's no need to verbalize that. When we are totally in touch with that sense experience, there's no need to verbalize. Poets verbalize it. But when we're having the experience, there doesn't have to be an internal monologue. This is why it's so important to open to our senses, to practice that over and over again as we sit, to be in touch with what's arising, you know, hearing, you know, tingling, whatever we're feeling through the senses, to have that direct experience with no explanation. No question about it. You're just there knowing that it's happening. And now this is, I believe it's one of the reasons why so many of us love to be in nature. There's really nothing you have to do or figure out. You know, you can just be out in the forest, or you can just be out there on the lawn, and you can just be seeing and smelling and feeling the air on your face, and there's no need to verbalize it. And in fact, it can be downright annoying if you're with someone and they want to start talking about it and telling you how wonderful it is. You're there experiencing it, they're telling you about it. Or worse yet, you're there experiencing and you're telling yourself about it. Bhante Gunaratna, I don't know if some of you may have practiced with him. He has a monastery down in Virginia. And a really wonderful monk. I think he's in his 80s, very frail little guy, but he's very wonderful. And he says, peace is not, what does he say? It's not a, peace is not a concept. Peace is a nonverbal experience. No. Peace is not a concept. It's just a nonverbal experience. Now, it's interesting that when we use words, as we're experiencing something, we sometimes do that. We sometimes begin verbalizing in the mind, or even out loud, but we verbalize in the mind to avoid the experience. And an example from my own practice, which was a huge example, was this one. A good example of papancha, proliferating thought. I was reporting to my teacher in the middle of a longer retreat that I just had nothing but planning thoughts. Planning, planning, planning. So this is a wonderful technique for working with thoughts. When you have persistent thoughts, either of one kind, plan, for example, nothing but planning thoughts all the time, or you have the same thought over and over and over again, that's driven by an unrecognized emotion. And tomorrow's talk is about thoughts and emotions, and working with emotions and thoughts together. So this is what my teacher said to me. I would like you, the next time you have a planning thought, to ask yourself, what was happening just before this thought came up? Well, maybe going through your mind, what a ridiculous request. At least that's what went through my mind. I'm hoping that it's common. But it was like, how would I know? I'm now in the planning thought. How would I remember what came before that? But the mind is wonderful in some ways. I mean, it tortures you in some ways, but it's absolutely wonderful facility that we have. To just put that question in the back of my mind, okay, the next time I have a planning thought, I'm going to just say, what was going on before, just before that came up? And the first 5 or 10 times you ask yourself, and it's not like spending minutes about it, you just ask the question, the answer doesn't come, so you just do it again another time and another time, and then eventually, boom, what was happening just before that? And I recognized that I'd been in a significant amount of chronic pain for the past couple of years, and it was really bad during that retreat, and that every time the pain, because that discomfort was just draining. And so when it started to come up, when I'd been tired of paying attention to it and releasing it and doing all of that, I just quickly went into planning gear, and it was so entertaining and wonderful, and you can really, and it was legitimate because I had the kind of work that required a lot of planning, so I was getting a lot of work done at the same time. And it was intriguing, and I was brilliant, I have to tell you. But that's what it was. And it was so enlightening. I mean, it was a huge, huge understanding. So if any of you have that happening to you in the mind, you're sitting, you're tending to what's happening in the moment, and the next thing you're off into, what are some of these creative thought patterns? Worrying is one common pattern. Worrying, you should, and I'll talk about this in a few minutes. Remembering, sometimes the pattern can be just remembering. You're always in the past, right? This memory comes up, that memory comes up, and you just get lost in these memories. That's the habit of like going back there. And wasn't that wonderful, or ain't that terrible? It could be either way. So there's worrying, there's remembering, there's planning, there's judging. Those of us who are aversive can really get into judging. You can just sit there and start reciting a litany of things that aren't right about this retreat right here, starting with the person next to you and the one behind you. Coughing, breathing too hard, sitting too close, and you can just go through your whole bunch of judgments. So here's a way of working with your thoughts. When a thought comes up and you become aware of it, and as you practice more and your practice deepens, and your practice is to be on track, noticing a thought when it's come up in the mind, as soon as you recognize it, you can name it. You just, okay, that was a memory. Right? That was remembering. Okay, and the next thought that comes up, oh, that was planning. In other words, you're not trying to make your thoughts any certain way, but you're giving yourself some information. You've got some habitual thought patterns. That's a habit of mind. So it's an interesting thing to know. Interesting thing to know. And then when it becomes a pattern, I'm always worrying, I'm always fretting. Some of you may have read Sylvia Boorstein's book. She's written several. Don't just stand there, sit. No, don't just.
Don't just do something.
Don't do something, just sit there. That's right. Well, she's written two or three very good books, and she's quite a wonderful woman. And had some great talks with her. And she's a fretter. She's a worrier. And she's been a worrier all her life. That's her habitual thought pattern. And it's been really, we've talked about how, she's been able to work with that and how she tries to avoid worrying. It's been such torture that she will do almost anything to distract herself. That this is in the past. She has this wonderful story about parking in a big shopping center there. She lives in California. It must have been in San Francisco or somewhere in the environments. And she went in to shop. And when she came out, someone had stolen the wheels off her car. And so she thought she could either sit there and worry about it or she could do something else. So she went right back into Macy's and bought silk pajamas. But that's a perfect thing that we do, like a huge exaggeration of what we do. Right? You go off and do something. You're driven by something because it's just too torturous to go into this. Or else you could just go into the worrying pattern and then do something equally ridiculous out of the depths of your worries. But I thought that was wonderfully creative. It was something I would never think of doing. And I thought, Sylvia, you're brilliant. So, so I'm going to just put this to you as a way of working with your thoughts. And that is, as a thought comes up, just take a moment to notice it. Just to note worrying or remembering or planning. That takes you into the future. See, worrying is right here in the present. It's a confusion usually. Worrying, planning, remembering, and judging. Judging is a big one too. Having, judging, whether it's judging pluses or minuses, it doesn't matter. And you'll soon become acquainted with your own thought pattern, and you can start asking yourself as that particular pattern comes up to just ask the question. Just take a, 4 or 5 seconds to just say, what was happening just before that popped up? It doesn't matter if it doesn't come up. Just continue to ask the question. Eventually, it will reveal itself. So you'll be learning about your habits of mind. This is what we're talking about, habits of mind. Why? Because sometimes we do very ridiculous things, harmful things, unskillful things, unwise things. Like the captain of the aircraft carrier or the Rachel Naomi Raymond's father, his whole life, a way of looking at the world, that it was just one big disaster waiting to happen, one after another. Being mistrustful, people can't be trusted. Is this? Yeah. So very often we express thoughts to avoid our experience, and sometimes we use it to distract ourselves from experience. But very seldom are the thoughts very productive. So it's always important to be curious, but stop thinking. In fact, there's some wonderful teachings about thoughts. You'd think that Buddhists would be on the bandwagon to have everyone lobotomized or something. I don't know, because teachings are the natural abiding. Don't do anything whatsoever with the mind. Abide in an authentic, natural state. One's own mind, unwavering, is reality. The key is to meditate like this without wavering. Experience the great reality beyond extremes. In a pellucid ocean. It's like, because thoughts have no substance. They're just like bubbles. They just come up. I don't think you argue that they just come up at the least convenient time, or at least when you don't expect them. Bubbles are, you know, experience the great reality beyond extremes. In a pellucid ocean, bubbles arise and dissolve again. Just so thoughts are no different from ultimate reality. So don't find fault, remain at ease. Whatever arises, whatever occurs, don't grasp, release it on the spot. And there's the other great teaching here. It's the thoughts themselves. There's nothing wrong with them, but the thing is we identify with them. We believe they're true. They're about me. They're about mine. These thoughts that come are mine. You know. Grab the thought, you know, the leg is asleep, and the circulation is gone, and my leg is going to be cut off. This is it. I just take it, grab it, and hold on to it. In a pellucid ocean, bubbles arise and dissolve again. Just so. Thoughts are no different from ultimate reality, so don't find fault. Remain at ease. Whatever arises, whatever occurs, don't grasp, release it on the spot. Appearances, sounds, and objects are one's own mind. There's nothing except mind. Mind is beyond the extremes of birth and death. The nature of mind, awareness, although using the objects of the five senses, does not wander from reality. And it's talking about the natural mind, doesn't wander from reality. In a state of cosmic equilibrium, there's nothing to abandon or practice. No meditation or post-meditation, just this. Just use the objects of the five senses. And then the natural mind doesn't wander from reality. Now, there's some wonderful comments in the verses in the faith mind. I love these wonderful two or three line pieces of advice. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. He says, the more you talk and think about it, the further you stray and wander from the truth. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you'll not be able to know. Do not search for the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. It goes on and on. So when the thoughts arise in meditation, it's important not to feed them. Not to feed them with words, and then silence will come. If you can stay in the experience of the senses, a sensation arises, a sound arises, hearing happens, you don't have to explain it. You don't have to prefer it or not prefer it. To just let it be the pure sensation of hearing from beginning to end. I could just do this. Someone in this room will be saying, I love that bell. And someone else will be saying, boy, that the bigger bell had a better sound to it. Okay. So when thoughts arise in meditation, the thoughts are not the problem. Thoughts are the nature of mind. The problem is that we want to grab onto them. We want to identify with them, we want to verbalize them, we want to make something out of them. So here are some common mental habits that color the mind. And so I will read them to you and elaborate a little bit, and I would like you to see if you can find something that's familiar in here. Incidentally, for for those of you who have, well, most of us, I guess, who have read or had some brush with Christianity, with a Christian religion and so on, we know about the seven deadly sins, right? Pride, avarice, lust, anger, glutton, envy, and sloth. We learned that in grade 4 in my Catholic school. I can't remember my own phone number, but got that one. Well, this is interesting because these are habits of mind, and here they are. They're related to greed, hatred, and delusion. There's pride, you know, I am, that sense of self, that's pride. Avarice, which of course is related to greed, wanting this. Lust and gluttony, these are all manifestations, seven deadly sins, they are manifestations of greed. Maybe this is something that colors, you know, there's a little tinge of that in your thoughts. Maybe it's the way where your habits of mind spring from, what they're colored by. Or it could be ill will, like anger and envy. These are manifestations of ill will. And sloth, this is the word, ignorance, you know, ignorance, non-involvement, laziness, if we want to use a term. Those are all, you know, habit of mind, don't want to look at that, don't want to be bothered, no, I'm too tired to, or I don't want to get involved with that. These are all manifestations of sloth and excessive self-interest. So there they are. These are mental habits that color the mind and distort our perception. And it's from those distorted perceptions, from our perceptions, distorted or not, that's where the thoughts arise from. So there we are again. Greed, ill will, ignorance. Or if you want to recite the seven deadly sins, pride, avarice, lust, anger, glutton, envy, and sloth. So you can just think about that. It doesn't have to be thought about, but notice it when you're entertain the possibility that in your next few sittings you can deliberately pay close attention to the kind of thought that arises without judging it, but just noticing. Oh, that's remembering. No, that's worrying, or that's planning, or whatever. And just see once you've identified that, you know, the place to go then is to try to recall what happened when just before that landslide started, you know, just think what was going on. Not a lot of thinking, just noticing, giving yourself a few moments, and eventually the answer will come. Eventually the answer will come. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that a thought about the experience isn't the experience. A thought about an experience or an opinion about it isn't the experience itself. And again, I know I've said this once, but before, oftentimes thinking about is the avoidance of the direct experience. Thinking about it, embellishing it, working it over in your mind is a way of actually stopping the experience. That's what you're doing. You're taking your attention away from the actual experience of tightness in the chest or buzzing in the head or annoyance with the sound. It's to start talking about it is to move away from the experience. What's interesting, I'm just recalling this now, in a longer retreat at Insight Meditation Society, it was in the fall, and there was a dog that belonged to a neighbor, and he was some kind of a hound, I think a little basset or something, but he didn't make, you know, those barking noises. But he was very busy all the time. If he were here, he would be running around with his nose in the leaves, and that's basically what he was doing. And he was always snuffling around the Dharma Hall, and he had a bell on his collar. And so we'd be sitting, and you could just hear this, dingle, 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 and he'd come closer, and then he'd go and he'd be around at the other side. And he was just driving some people crazy. It was amazing, the thoughts that filled that room, because it happened that we had a question period about the fourth day of the dogs being around, and there was rage on the part of several people. Who does that dog belong to, and why has it got this bell on? And other people saying, oh, I was just imagining this little critter having so much fun out there and being busy. And the range of thoughts and the range of emotions that were stirred by that little dog and his bell were just amazing. And I remember Carol Wilson saying, oh, when I heard that, I thought about Switzerland, my favorite place. And because all the cows have bells, and each cow has a bell with a distinctive ring to it so that the farmer knows what cow it is when he hears it from a distance. You know, and other people were ready to go out and lynch the farmer that owned the dog, you know. So it's interesting. So I just want to say this, that this idea that to keep in mind that the thought about the experience isn't the experience itself. And this is what we're really going for. This is a practice of experiencing your own experience. Actually experiencing it directly. And again, it all comes through the senses, the six senses, which includes the thinking mind. And this mind that creates the thoughts, those thoughts come from habits of mind. And the habits of mind come from tendencies or habits of mind may be tinted or clouded or affected by either greed, hatred, or delusion, or the manifestations of. Okay, so that's basically a way of looking at it and of thinking of your thoughts, of noticing your thoughts, of noticing your own experience, and getting to the bottom of some of the attitudes and that you have, and some of the decisions that you make, and the directions in which your life goes. So then just remember, it's not the thoughts that are the problem, it's the way you relate to them. And when you identify with them, believe them and identify with them and think they have to do with you, that's when you're in trouble. I'm going to read again the Dhammapada. You are what you think. Oops, not there. Yeah, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts we make the world. Speak or act with an impure mind, and trouble will follow you as the wheel follows the ox that draws the cart. We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unshakable. How can a troubled mind understand the way? Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your thoughts unguarded. But once mastered, no one can help you as much, not even your father or your mother. So let's just sit for a moment. So we'll do a brief loving kindness meditation before we leave. Would you like to stand up for a moment to stretch, or is it fine to sit? It's okay. Well, just do whatever for the next couple of minutes. And as you take your seat, take a few moments to notice, all of you, where your heart is right now, how your heart feels at this moment, today, in this darkening afternoon. Sometimes the heart is very approachable and available, and sometimes the heart is very hidden and difficult to locate, and that's all right, but just notice. You might imagine your breath is coming in and out of that heart space, just breathing in and out feelings of friendliness and loving kindness. This is a complementary practice to our mindfulness practice. They are both practices of the heart and mind. And loving kindness is one of the natural expressions of the heart. It depends on two things: focusing on an image or a felt sense of the person or persons to whom you're extending loving kindness. And it focuses on the meaning of the phrases. And there are four traditional phrases which I'll offer to you. And as you repeat them to yourself, you may use your own words to express the same wish. So we'll begin by extending loving kindness to ourselves. So bring to mind an image or a felt sense of yourself. It could be an actual image, a picture, or a sense of your own image when you were a baby or a small child or as you are now, but one that conveys to you the essence of your own Buddha nature. You might say yourself at the top of your game with all of your wonderful human qualities of mind and heart. An image or a felt sense of yourself. And hold that as you repeat the phrases I suggest, or use your own wording as you wish. May I be safe from inner and outer harm. May I be happy just as I am. May I be healthy. May my body serve me well. May I be peaceful. And if you have another special wish for yourself today, just take a moment now to add that. And now open the heart and mind to include all of us here today who, in our sincere desire to be free from suffering, to be liberated, we all have sat and supported one another. It's the sense of all of us here together today. And then opening the heart and mind even further, include those who have supported you in other ways, who support you right now in your life, your family, your friends, either in images or just a sense of these people who are close to your heart, so much a part of your life and dear to you. And as the Buddha enjoins us to extend our loving kindness to all living beings, and he names them weak or strong, tall or stout, average or short, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, extending loving kindness to all beings. And if there's someone in your life to whom you would like to especially dedicate the metta of the group today, all of us here, who may be having some stress or some difficulty in their lives, who could benefit by the loving kindness of the group and all our best wishes, bring them to mind and heart and mention their names out loud. Bring their names, bring them into the circle. Let's hear the names. Joyce and Patrick, Sangha members. So we extend loving kindness to all these people and also to all the creatures that live in and on the earth, the creatures who live in the waters and the creatures of the air, extending loving kindness to all beings on this planet and to all beings in our universe and beyond. As we wish to be safe, may all beings be safe from inner and outer harm. As we wish to be happy, may all beings be happy just as they are. As we wish to be healthy, may all beings be healthy. May their bodies serve them well. And as we wish to be peaceful, may all beings live their lives in peace. And may all beings grow each day in compassion, in understanding, and in wisdom.